So we've been thinking about this series, the Gospel in Isaiah, and tonight we're going to look at these words from verse 6, or specifically the title given to Jesus, Counselor. And if you remember, Ian said last week in his introduction that sometimes we study the Bible using a large chunk and we think about its themes and so on. Sometimes we concentrate right down and we look on a little phrase or word. And tonight we're going to do the latter. We're just going to look at that one word, Counselor. And we're going to see what that word means. So we've got three things to say about that word. First of all, the necessary counselor. Secondly, the unlikely counselor. And third, the ultimate counselor. So first of all, we're going to ask ourselves a question. Why do we need a counselor? Why do we need a counselor? Well, if you think about the way we live at the minute, this is definitely the age of information. Smartphones, internet. We've got information coming out of our ears. You can't talk to a medical student for more than 10 seconds without the smartphone coming out. And everything, so you can look up anything you like, Google, Wikipedia, it's all there. Information coming out of our ears. But information isn't everything. You see, in order to live rightly in the world, we need more than just information. And there are several aspects to this. So say you have a difficulty or a decision to make. You don't know which way to go, which of several options to choose. A counsellor is someone who can help you. A good counsellor can help you to make good choices. Another aspect of it might be that you have a goal or a plan in mind, but you can't see the practical steps that you need to take to get that plan accomplished, turning your goal into a reality. Perhaps a counsellor can help you to see the longer term implications of your decisions, whereas you can only see things in the short term. Think of what a parent does for a child. The child would quite happily eat chocolate for every meal, but the parent can see the longer term implications of that are not good. Another aspect of this thing is something that we might call today emotional intelligence. If I asked you, what does the Bible say about how you're to answer a fool? How do you answer a fool according to his folly? Maybe one of the guys who was away at the weekend would know how to answer that question. How are you supposed to answer a fool according to his folly? Should you try to answer him or not? Difficult? Well, the answer is basically yes and no, because side by side are two verses, one of which tells us you should answer that fool, and the other saying you shouldn't. And the point being made there is that it requires wisdom to know how to speak in each sort of different situation. You might be in a conversation with someone and you're thinking, you know, have I talked too long here? Have I overstayed my welcome? Is now the right time to bring up that difficult subject I've been wanting to get to with this person? Another aspect of this is the ability to see distinctions. If we had a counsellor who could help us to see what to our untrained eye all looks sort of one or the other, sometimes we need help to see that there are gradations and nuances and distinctions that we don't immediately see. Someone who can help us see the practical steps we need to take to get to our longer term goals. We would find such a person very useful, would we not? More than useful. And those are the kind of things I've imagined a counsellor would help us with. And those things I've talked about, they correspond to different words the Bible uses for this idea of wisdom. Wisdom is a thing that the counsellor can give us. Now, if you think it's wisdom that we need in the way that I've described to sort out our problems, then we are really massively overestimating our ability to deal with what's wrong with us. Because we do have to admit that we do think if we could just make slightly better choices, then our lives and our relationships and our world would improve. But it's just not the case. There's a thing in the Guardian on Saturdays that's called King for a Day, and they invite some kind of usually famous person to say, this is what I would do if I was in charge of the country for one day, and they get to write a spiel about how I would kind of organise things. So there's one that was there recently that goes like this. Here's a bit of it. So if I were absolute potentate for the day, I would gather the finest, most passionate thinkers, feelers, and philanthropists in the world, put them together in the most comfortable and productive environment that power and riches could locate, and set them the task of finding a permanent, self-perpetuating solution to the inequality of wealth and opportunity across the globe. Now, that's a very worthy aim, but that goes way beyond the limits of what this world's wisdom is able to do. We can't fix those sort of problems just by getting the right people in the right room for the right amount of time. That massively overestimates our ability to deal with our problems. We give ourselves too much credit. What's wrong with us and with our world requires a lot more than just tweaking of our choices and making better choices. Now, everything I've said so far about this idea of wisdom, yes, it can help us when it comes to making choices. It can help us with all those things I've described. But our real problem is not that without this wisdom we don't make good choices, but that without this wisdom we can't make good choices. I'll say that again. Our real problem is that without this wisdom we don't make good choices, but without this wisdom, we cannot make good choices. Say you have a choice to make. One option would cause you to suffer a loss of reputation in the eyes of someone you value, say, or it would cost you financially to the extent that it would really impact on your lifestyle, or it would involve bringing an end to a relationship that would cause you a serious amount of heartache. You see, our problem is that these choices are against our selfish nature, and we just can't make them, at least not consistently. It's a bit like putting two meals in front of a lion. One is a slab of raw meat, and the other is a bowl of salad. 1,000 times out of 1,000, it will choose the raw meat. It just can't choose the salad because it's not in its nature. It would require a radical transformation of its nature and character to allow it to be able to choose a bowl of salad to eat. There's an argument that we always do the thing that we most want. And if you say, well, if somebody held a gun to my head and asked me to hand over my money, then I would do that, and I've done the thing that I don't want. But if you think about the fact that you were given a choice, we're given choices all the time, and you were given a choice there between your life or your money, and you've chosen the thing you most wanted. This is something that we always do. You always choose the thing you most want. And our problem is that we need a counselor who can transform our deepest wants and desires. There needs to be something that we want more than the reputation or the money or the comfort or whatever it is that we'll lose if we choose that option. We need a counselor who can work wisdom in us at that very deep level. Is there any wisdom anywhere in the world that can do that? There is not anywhere in this world wisdom that can do that. But what about Isaiah's counselor? Well, secondly, we're going to think about Isaiah's unlikely counselor. In that verse 6, Isaiah is talking about the arrival of this child, specifically his birth. Now, if you bear in mind the words of the song we sang just before, you would think that the arrival of this child would be something very great. It'd be some great sage or philosopher or teacher or guru. If it was down to us, we'd have chosen a major venue, a big city, perhaps royalty, celebrity, connections, qualifications. We would not have chosen for him to be born in a stable, in the middle of nowhere, in the midst of manure and urine. Born out of wedlock in a culture in which that was unthinkable. And then his early life, his escape to Egypt, his coming back to live in Nazareth. And then there's his life. He taught in a small area, in a backwater corner of the Roman Empire, wrote nothing down. He was outside all of the economic and political and social and academic and power networks of the day.
And in fact, not only was he outside the religious establishment of the day who were the people who ran things, but they actively set out to destroy him from day one. They were always up against him, and ultimately they got the better of him, and they had him killed after only 3 years of public ministry. And at that time, he had something like just over 100 people following him. And what was the message that those followers took out into the world? If you were here this morning, Ian described it as, in 1 Corinthians, this message is described as a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. Think about what it would have been like for them to take this message, first of all, to the Jews. Guess what? Yahweh, the great uncreated creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Moses, David, has become a human being. Imagine what kind of human being the Jews must have thought this would be like. Yes, he's a penniless preacher who was crucified. That's the deliverer of our nation. And even the very best of you are unclean unless you believe in him. How well do you think that went down? How do you think they got on when they went to the Greek and the Roman worlds? Now, in those cultures, they believed, like Aristotle and Plato, that things like truth and beauty and justice were cosmic ideals that dwelt in the immaterial realm above history. And these Christian missionaries have to go to them and say, guess what? Truth and beauty and justice have become a historical particular. Not only that, but an actual person. People must have thought, wow, what kind of person must this be that embodies truth and beauty and justice in his own person? Yes, he's an executed criminal in a backwater corner of the Roman Empire. And by the way, unless you believe in him, you're completely lost. How do you think that message went down? A stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greeks. As Ian said this morning, that must have seemed a weak and pathetic message in many ways. And yet, 2,000 years later, 3/4 of humanity know his name. 1/4 of humanity centers their entire lives around him. And his body of teaching is easily the most influential in the whole of the human race. Civilizations built on his teaching, that is indeed tremendous wisdom. But where in his life did we see this tremendous wisdom? Where exactly is it? If you were here again this morning, Ian talked about Jesus referring to himself as one greater than Solomon, the archetypal wise man of the Old Testament. Where's the wisdom in all of this? We have to look at Jesus' teaching to see it. And if you remember when we were here, if you're here last Sunday night, Ian referred to two episodes in Jesus' life where even if we hear his words, if we have no idea what Jesus was talking about, even if you hear his words in these two situations, we automatically recognize that as being very, very wise. Well, let's have a quick look at those two scenarios and see what is it about him that was so wise that was able to take his message so widely around the world. The two incidents we talked about were both examples where he was challenged with a question and he gave an answer and there was a real edge to his answer. And we recognize it as being very, very wise, but not just cryptic or clever in the abstract. His answers do two things. They always point in some way to himself, and they always seem to point to something completely unexpected or upside down about his way of doing things. I'm going to show you these two examples. First of all, take the incident with the coin. You remember the religious leaders come to Jesus and they say, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Now, what they were talking about is a specific tax called the head tax. And previously, there had been a revolution in that area about the introduction of this tax. Very unpopular, as you can imagine. And the question is designed to trap Jesus into either saying pay taxes to Caesar so that his followers would then sort of give up on him, or don't pay taxes, in which case it's another armed revolt like the previous ones. You see, what they're really asking him is, are you a revolutionary? Okay? And his answer is incredibly sophisticated because what he says is, if you remember, his answer is give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give to God's the things that are God's. Because what Jesus is saying is, yes, I am a revolutionary, but it's not the kind of revolution that you think. You see, every other revolution is based on acquiring money or power or reputation in some way. I am a king. I bring a kingdom. I am starting a revolution. But the dynamic behind my revolution is completely the opposite. It involves giving up money and giving up power and giving up influence to an infinite degree, to the point of my own death. This revolution starts with Jesus' death and about 100 followers, and look where it went. A very wise answer indeed. Take the other incident we talked about, which is the woman who was caught in adultery. And again, you remember the scene. And again, Jesus' answer has a real edge to it, and it points back to himself and what he's going to do. You remember that they're trying to trap Jesus into saying that he should see this woman stoned because of her crime. And Jesus, you remember his words, he says, let the person who hasn't sinned then throw the first stone. And of course, they all disappear. And Jesus is left with the woman, and he's doodling on the ground, if you remember. And do you remember what he says to her at the very, very end? He tells her to go her own way. Neither do I condemn you. Neither do I condemn you. Now, Jesus is claiming to be God. He's claiming to have the right to stand in judgment over everything. He's claiming that he's come to fulfill the whole law of Moses. Every jot and tittle, he says, every letter of the law he's coming to fulfill. There's no doubt about what the law says, about what she's done. And yet he says to her, I don't condemn you. What can that mean? What must he be going to do that lets a guilty person who's clearly guilty go free, but at the same time uphold the law of Moses? How on earth is Jesus going to be able to achieve that? And this is what he's pointing to. His own death, of course. Thirdly, the ultimate counselor. Now, there's a sermon by the famous preacher Spurgeon on this same word. And in one of his points, I'm going to read out some of it. It goes a bit like this. He's talking about Christ's counsel as being what he calls a hearty counsel. And by that he means it's sympathetic. And there's a slide with the words on it. Yeah. Now, apologies to Cyprian and Malcolm, anyone else connected with the law profession, but these are the words of Spurgeon here. He goes like this. He says, I hate to go to a lawyer above all people to talk to him upon matters of business. These are not my words, okay? The worst kind of conversation is with a lawyer. There's your case. Dear me, what an interest you feel in it. You spread it out before him and he says, there's a word on the second page that's not quite correct. You look and say, that's totally unimportant. He turns to another clause and says, ah, there's a good deal here. My dear fellow, you say, I don't care about any of those petty clauses, whether it says lands or properties or hereditaments. What I want you to do is set this difficulty right in point of law. He's as cool as possible. You think you're asking counsel of a block of marble. What is it to him whether you succeed or not? He takes a professional interest in your case only. He does not enter into the sympathies of the matter with you. Now, what Spurgeon is trying to do there is to point out the difference between somebody who takes just a professional interest in your problems and somebody who actually enters into your problems with you, actually feels the pain with you, actually has sympathy with you. And of course, apologies to the lawyers here for that. But you see what he's talking about. You see, we need a lawyer to help us with our problem. You see, the lawyer, I mean, we can't live without them. The lawyer doesn't just advise the client and leave them to face the judge alone. The lawyer actually represents the client in front of the judge. But shall we see what Christ does with our case before the judge? Do you realize why it is that Christ keeps talking about himself and his death? Do you realize why his wisdom doesn't just enable you to make better choices and see more options and realize more and realize your goals but actually transforms your nature so that you can make choices you never could before. Transforms your deepest desires so that you can actually choose other than your own comfort and happiness and ease. Do you know what Christ does with your case? Yes, he takes it before his father, the judge. And yes, he pleads on your behalf, as we would expect the lawyer to do. But do you realize what his case is? Do you think there's any chance that Christ's case on your behalf can fail? Now, you might think that he argues something like this. Father, would you forgive Pete Corrie because he's messed up again? Please, in your mercy, for my sake, would you give him one more chance? Okay, that's what we might imagine he is saying before the judge. And if he did that, that would be great. But we would always be wondering, might God's mercy ever be exhausted? Could Pete Corrie mess up one time too many and actually exhaust that mercy? Will he be able to keep it up forever? You see, that's not the case Jesus brings before the judge. He has a better case than that. He does not try to argue that Pete Corrie didn't mess up. That's not in doubt. We're 100% agreed about that. He does not try to argue that there were extenuating circumstances, that Pete Corrie was provoked, that he was having a bad day, that he was under pressure that day. He doesn't try to barter with the judge about the punishment. The crime is clear and the punishment is clear. No, you see, the reason Jesus' counsel is so bound up with his death is that he appeals not to God's mercy, but to God's justice. He's saying, yes, Pete Corrie has messed up again, and yes, he deserves punishment, but I have paid the price for that. I have dealt with the penalty. I have died on the cross. I have given my blood to pay for those crimes. It would be unjust of you to claim a second punishment, and you have to let him off in your justice. His crimes are paid for. That case is infallible. That's what Jesus brings to the Father, to those who are his. That leaves us with the question, how do we engage with his wisdom? How do we relate to it? How do we plug into it? How do we benefit from it? Well, we need to think about Isaiah's word again. He uses the word counselor. He's talking about a person, a real person. He's not talking about an abstract wisdom thing. He's talking about a real person who came into the world. And with a person, you have a relationship. And to answer the question, how do you go about plugging into this wisdom? How do you go about downloading it into your life? How do you make it operative in your life? How do you use it to be less anxious and less materialistic and less upset by failure or criticism? How do you use it to make choices you couldn't make before? How do you let this wisdom radically change your life? It's not counsel, it's a counselor. And he's talking about a person. You engage with his wisdom in the same way that you develop a personal relationship. And it's very like a marriage. In fact, it's described in those terms elsewhere. Isaiah 62, Hosea chapter 2, Ezekiel 16. You see, it's a unique relationship. Marriage is different to all other relationships in that it has both a formal legal element and it's also a personal relationship. And because it's a formal legal relationship, that means on one hand that there's a formal obligation there to make it work. If it gets difficult, you can't just back out of it. There's a legal binding commitment that doesn't exist in any of our other personal relationships that gives us an absolute confidence. But on the other hand, it means that I can live with a freedom and a confidence that I don't have in my other relationships because Dell has made the same commitment to me and I can be sure of it and it's permanent. And in that way, it gives joy and freedom. And that's how we engage with the counselor. It's a personal relationship based on a binding contract. Now, this has two implications, which we're going to finish with. First of all, just like in a marriage, there's a black and white element to it. There's an in or out, all or nothing aspect to it. Either he's engaged as your counselor, your legal representative, or he's not. If you haven't engaged him as your representative, then you're handling your own case And maybe you need to see for the first time how you stand before the judge. Maybe you need to look for the first time at your own ability to present your own case. How does it measure up to the case that he is going to bring on your behalf? Because if you're not, to use that, if you're not married to him, as it were, then you don't have his legal representation to make your case. And when you appear in front of the judge, you will have to make your own case. He's got an infallible, watertight, can't fail, signed and sealed, all paid for case, as I've described. But to be in that, you have to be committed to that relationship to get the benefit of it. How do you get yourself into that relationship? Well, just like with the lawyer, you have to hand over control to him. You have to put your weight on him, entrust your case to him, give him charge of your affairs. And can you see now how that would transform any decision you have to make if he is your counselor in that respect? Before you were thinking, shall I do X or Y perhaps? And when you see him, when you see what it cost him to take on your case, what he had to pay in order to sort out your case before the judge, when you let that sink in, that transforms how you even think about the choice in front of you at the very deepest level. And now it might not be, shall I do X or Y? But when I see what he did for me, should I even be thinking about X versus Y? Is there something else more important in my life? It transforms everything, the way you think about everything, if he is your counselor. Maybe something else altogether is more important if he is my counselor, if he is in charge of my case. And if you're thinking, well, this is all very interesting, and I would like to think about this idea of Jesus and my case before the judge, but I really would like to know answers to some questions first. I'd like to think about, what does the Bible say about war or poverty or other religions and so on? And if you were here this morning, you remember we talked a little bit about that. People ask for a sign because they wanted to see Jesus do something amazing. But the point is, Jesus' claims are so radical that they must transform the way you think about everything else. So you can't really ask the question, what does Christianity say about X, whatever it is, without thinking, what does it say about him first? Because that affects your answer to everything else. So don't put off thinking about him because you want to get Christianity's answer to some other subject. You've got to start with what it says about him and his claims first of all. And then for those perhaps who are already belong to Jesus, you already call yourselves Christians, you have already entrusted your case to him, you're already married to him, and you need his guidance and his advice for living. You need his guidance to make choices. You need his guidance to realize goals. You need his guidance to make distinctions. How do you get that wisdom? How do you get that? Well, just as in marriage, there's a legal all or nothing aspect to it, but at the same time, there's a personal aspect to it that's subject to degrees. It's a relationship. It can wax and wane. It has good days and it had bad days. It goes hot and cold. It goes up and down. But over time, it can be made to grow into something beautiful as time goes on. How do you do that? Like in any personal relationship, there is commitment. There's study. There's submission, communication, sharing, exclusivity, trust, confession, reconciliation, delight in the other person. All these other aspects of a personal relationship are all true of your relationship with the counselor. So when you make decisions, or you have decisions to make with him in front of you as your counselor, if we're married to him, if we love him, like in any good relationship, the thing we really want now, the thing we want most deeply, now that we've been transformed, is what our lover wants. That's how a really good relationship wants. What you want is actually what your partner or lover wants. You want to align your decision with their will. You're consulting his wishes and desires at every step. And that's how a personal relationship works, and that's what we want. That's how we engage with the wisdom of our counselor. We get deeper into the personal relationship using all of those disciplines. We've been thinking recently, have we not, about our church situation here in this meeting in this school and what shall we do next, and we have some money and so on and so on. And we need, of course, we need wisdom for that. We need the wisdom that helps you to see what to choose between different options. We need the wisdom that sees distinctions between different things. I mean, we're already seeing, are we not, that it's not all about having and owning a building versus not. There are aspects of our work that we are recognizing that can be done perhaps from our own homes or from other situations. There are distinctions and gradations that we need to see. There's the wisdom of realizing goals, of making the practical steps we need to make to realize our goals. We need all of those things. We need the wisdom that separates reality from appearance. We need the wisdom that sees the long-term outcome and so on. How do we as a church get that wisdom from our counselor? Well, it just comes down to all of those disciplines, getting into that personal relationship, not just as individuals, but corporately as a body. To the degree that you engage in these disciplines of developing the love relationship, to the degree that you work on the personal aspect of the relationship, to that degree we will have wisdom for making choices, making distinctions, realizing goals, how much we need the counsel of the ultimate counselor. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we have seen that you are described as the counselor, and how we need your wisdom. We need your wisdom to take our case before the judge, because we cannot make our own case, and we rely on your death, having paid the price for what we've done wrong. We need your wisdom for all the aspects of our individual and corporate life, to realize our goals, to make choices, to see distinctions. And we pray now for each one here that wisdom would come into our hearts in the way that we need it. In Jesus' name, amen.